Your friends are this way. Why is this made different from all other nights? What are we being asked to remember? Can it be a more terrible thing in this world than to be forgotten? In times of war, in war preparation, in war threat, Christ is forgotten. The book is closed. Another book is on the altar, something known as the Handbook of Violence. And just war, unnecessary, useless, are taken for granted and are held out of once more. For ourselves, dear friends, it seems we may have to remember this means opening the door, means taking it seriously, means pronouncing the unlikely and unloved command of Christ, so that it moves our hearts and minds and days and nights. Love your enemies, do good to those who do not love you. Let us remember, let us remember, let us restore our own humanity through Christ our Lord. Amen. So, for those of you who care to share with us, I think the only way to do this is to ask people, to begin a laundry and come up and join me at another point. I'll tell you a story about the church. You could go for moments of silence also, as you remember and think about it for a second. I did have a comment from Chad Meyer, the great friend of the church, to initiate this story from connection. So, I'm going to tell some of these. I'm going to try and be stern and keep people to somewhere in the realm of 3 minutes at the very most.
Carmen asked me to try to kick this off with a funny story. But there are much better funny storytellers in this room than me. So instead, I'm just going to sing a song. So, Liz, Dan, Jerry, Rita, Katie, Laura, Jim.
New one.
The West Coast sends our love.
Leaves are falling all around us. Leaves are falling all around. Leaves are falling all around. The best ones among us are gone home. The best ones among us are gone home.
Sisters and brothers, let's tell the story.
Yeah.
Someone started to laugh. People just keep coming forward and stand here. I wrote me one very brief story, but I let you know what I've heard in the last few days as some of the great friends and certainly the incredible family were gathered around the as the college very beautiful before. The banner that you see up there, the Swords of the Cloudshare banner, that happened on the living room floor of the young house. Elizabeth Palace came out with some of those clothes and gave it to the family, gave it to Priya and the other children in the house. And they cut up those arms and made that banner. And the person who confronted death in his life and his family has confronted with death and it's so much a resurrection banner. It seems to me that you should know that. You should know that Philip made a command to his son Jerry, young Jerry Berry, to make this coffin. And it was in the basement of the young house that the coffin was made for Philip Berry. With the help of some of the other churches in there, so with the help of some of the other people in the community. And the great end of Ashton is a former friend of mine, and so many of us are born, raising so many of the publications, maybe spent days very embracing painting for roses and the community on the call. So I spent all my life, so much of it is in honor of this family that has consistently, persistently confronted death, watched them do so in the face of death, and Philip himself confronted it, and you know someone in the heart of hearts overcome it. And I have given grace to watch that happen from that. And now I get alarmed. And I did not want to listen to this.
It would probably be wise to state your name and give some sense of your affiliation prior to the beginning.
Hi, I'm Steve Claiborne, and I live in Washington, D.C., and work with a group that is trying to end homelessness. And I have something I brought tonight. It's a letter from May 4th, 1974, 1977. And it was a letter that Phil wrote to me when I was in the Arlington County Jail. I just want to read the first paragraph. Dear Steve, been neglecting you fearfully. Hope all goes well and Big Brother's free and guilty. It used to strike me that whatever the overall deficiencies of hospitality or conscience, the material assets are superior to those afforded the poor. Doesn't that sound like a bill? And what this means to me personally over all these years is that while there were times in the peace movement and times to be civil disobedient, times to go to jail, there's also times to be faithful to this notion that the poor deserve better than what we allow them here in this country. And when I reread Phil's words all these years later, it's with a sense of comfort and understanding that in our separate lives, that were separate for so many years, we knew of each other's commitments across long times and spaces. This brother gave courage to many of us, myself included, and I thank him for that.
Memories of being with Phil in rather small spaces, in a closet, getting arrested. In another small space, a cell we shared, in the hole, fasting. A little more pleasantly on the yard, lying there with our former friend, Boyd Douglas. Phil, my lanky, straight up, laconic, anti-war buddy. My main life mentor, giving direction to my life. And he kept on giving direction, well, but he did. They got hard. Shalom, peace, my friend. We will meet again. Phil, you already know who I am. I'm John Katz. I was on the criminal defense team for the Durantown case. You have touched my life. The rest of the five sheriffs have as well. Everyone at John House has. You did not turn me into a radical pacifist. You did not turn me into a Christian or a Catholic. Of course, Catholics are Christians. But you did not. Was around January of 2000 when you were a parent to your child and you never heard of me or met me much time before that. And yet you gave it your trust and you gave it of yourself and you gave it your spirit and you worked together. And you met me when I was in the process already of shedding the lawyer in me and bringing more of the human of me out, and you helped me accelerate that pace tremendously. And something that struck me was, people can say as much as they want, that you gave up so much of your liberty for so many accumulated years, but I saw a real example of that when I was meeting with you. Ramsey Clark and I were in the cell with you and Steve Kelly, not in the cell, but the meeting room, Steve before trial, and they came over with a meal, and you and Steve were so hungry that we both said, "Do you mind if we start eating?" And we said, "Of course." And that really helps show how much freedom and liberty you really gave up, that you couldn't even fix your own meal for yourself, let alone that you were behind bars. Shalom Chabad. Peace, my friend.
Hi, I'm Marianne Grady Flores from the Ithaca Catholic Worker Community. And Dan, Liz, Carol, Jim, Friedenheim, Rosalie, and Katie, and Jerry, Mom, and everybody in the family. I just wanted to share something with people about this week. Well, first of all, our families go back to, my dad always said that he met you, Dan, the night after I was born, so it's many years back. And I'm so grateful for all the years of our intertwined lives, the Brady's and the Americans, and the so many gatherings and actions. And anyway, and to this week, I just wanted to say that last Saturday specifically, going into the room with Phil and being invited by the family to that sacred moment of the anointing with you, Daniel, and with Liz, and with the family. We had small groups of us that gathered around the small bedroom, office-made bedroom, and just witnessing Phil lying there so in such royal state, with this beautiful, rich coat that lay upon him, and to see his face, which had been drawn because of the illness, and his hair, it just framed his beautiful, strong bone structure, his handsome face. And he lay there with his eyes closed, and then as Steve Kelly anointed him and swathed him with the oils, he looked up at each of us and acknowledged us. And I think about an image that I've been sharing with people this week, is the fact that Phil helped invite us in this process of learning how to be peacemakers, and then to witness your family in the midwifing of him into the next stage of the life of his spirit, was such a blessing. And on the community, like Willow and Brendan, and all of you, it was very, very special. And I wanted to share one short story. My sister, my son Diego's girlfriend, Ellen, who wants to be a midwife, had tried to get to my niece Saoirse's birth. And we thought the birth was going to happen early in the morning. It took a lot longer, and I had to go to work. Ellen chose to come with me and leave the birth scene, and we made it half an hour after the baby was born. So I shared this with the midwife, that this young woman made a sacrifice, and then came back. And the midwife said, "You are going to be the best midwife because you understand that it's not about you, that the process has to happen anyway, and it will. And we are there. We midwives are only called to be in support." And that's what I saw in your family this week, and our whole donor house community. And that was such a blessing. So thank you to each of you, and for all the extended community. Amen. And thank you to Phil for being our midwife for this whole process. I think the difficulty for me in trying to share about Phil is trying to pick out 3 minutes worth of material, because he's been so important in my life for 20 years. When I first came to Jonah House, I came much like Nicodemus, asking, can I be born again? And Phil, with his ever humble spirit body, basically said, damn well better be. And within a short time, I found myself living at Jonah House like so many others, sort of going through what I think of as my spiritual formation. And, you know, you can share about Bible studies and Sunday liturgy and parent interactions, but the memories that really I cling to are memories of going house painting with him and being instructed not only in the fine points of resistance, but of getting the paint just right, because it would be wasteful to be painting nearly decoratively, that you had to do it to keep things whole and solid, and that seems to be an important thing with Phil. I think one of the things that impressed me most, we all know how much time Phil spent in jail, but anyone who ever spent any time at Jonah House knows how much he loved to be home with his family, with Liz and with the kids and with the community, and how we nourished each other. And one of my favorite memories of that are some of the nights we spent playing games. I remember that Liz always tested her nonviolence and her really acute approach to Scrabble. But I can remember a new game had just come out called Trivial Pursuit. We were hanging out one night around the dining room table, and Freeze, who was about 6 or 7 at the time, was playing with us. And I think she was playing for a piece of pie or something, and she had a history question. And the question went, name the 2 Catholic priests who were in the pie. Daddy and Uncle Dan. And so what I love most about you is your fierce refusal over the years to refuse to allow our culture to relegate you to, at best, history, or at worst, a Trivial Pursuit question, or a game show answer. I love your insistence on being a faithful father and husband, community member and friend. And because you were all of those things, you were truly able to be a peacemaker, because you knew that peacemaking meant not just saying no to the evil of the world, but holding up and nourishing and bringing forth new life. And that's what Phil was all about to me.
Mine is very short story. I met Phil by Ernest Brown in 1968. 4 of us Christian brothers that came down from Philadelphia. We were going to be employed in public schools, and just by fathers got a grant for us, and on a particular Saturday in the spring of 68, we found ourselves on the rectory having lunch, and that's when I met Phil. And we were very much aware of what had happened, what was in the news, what Phil had done, what the people had wanted to actually take to Phil. As we sat at the table, Phil always brought the discussion back to our project. He was enthusiastic about our project. He didn't have time to talk about what he had done. And later that year, in the fall of 68, Tim Crimmins, a young brother of myself, went out to the Pokie in Towson. And it was a forbidding place, the visiting room where she and Steele and we had last minute to talk to. And the thing I'll never forget about Phil, as we sat down to talk to him from our side, our freedom side, he said, "This must be awfully tough on you." Always other regarding. He's always other regarding, and he's regarding us from a place of triumph.
My name is Joyce Katzberg, and I'm from the smallest town in the smallest town in the smallest state. To tell you that nobody gets out of here alive. That may sound a little flippant, but the truth is that we all die, and that's not the end. And so I bring you Bill, I bring you this beautiful family of people, dinners, all of you who have given me not so much something to worry about in my afterlife, but a code to live in this one. And so I'm going to offer this little song. If you knew that this was going to be your very last day, would you find all the words you needed to say to the ones that you have hurt or loved along the way? If you knew that this was going to be your very last day, if you knew in the morning this would be your last, would you kneel and pray? Would you feast or fast? Would you celebrate all the choices you have made in the past? If you knew in the morning it would be your last, and in the afternoon, that afternoon, would you call all of your loved ones around? And in the silence of that evening falls on your very last night, would you count all the times you stood for what's right? Would you find yourself among the hawks or doves in flight? If you knew that this was going to be your very last night, if you knew this was going to be last day, would you find all the words you needed to say to the ones you have hurt or loved along the way? If you knew this was going to be your very last day, shalom, sweet dreams, Phil.
I'm Linehan from the Illinois Peace Community, King Craig, Georgia, and now Jacksonville. In the early 80s, Martina and I were in a peace community in Florida enjoying the sun and the surf. Phil Berrigan came to visit us and told us we were doing very well as a prayer community, but lacking a little bit in action. Himself and seven others from the Atlanta Flight community who shot us into action with the Persian powershares in Orlando. But as Martina and I were driving here today, and by the way, there's Shifty up here, but she's the introvert, not the extrovert, unfortunately. We were driving here, and we associated with Phil, really, spin-offs in Florida, the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice, Hearts Christi, Florida, the Southern Life Community, the Contrived to Life Community, all in the Southeast. And then the major spin-off now is the Global Network Against Nukes in Space, the Bruce Gag and the Man. All of those are spin-offs from the gentle reminder way back in the 70s. Prayer is great, but prayer to action too.
I'm Jim Cook from Binghamton Catholic Order. I was at the Warren College in the late 60s when I heard Dan and Phil become Lutheran and Lutheran and Lutheran destroying the draft records. And I felt that moment as if the chain had broken. So I reminded myself of looking at it. The chain was broken, and the ability to make decisions on your own. I first met Phil and came out of jail at that time. Came out of prison. The story that I have is very short, but it's not very profound. I do remember going to the Pentagon in December of 77. We were in a blockade escalator. And of course, at that time, you get into the building of Jesus, and you get into the train station, and we had one person who went up to the top of the escalator, shut the escalator off so no one could hurt. And then there were six of us, we were supposed to get down to the bottom there. And I in my nerves, since I always get nervous in arrest situations, even now I think it's 55, I still get nervous in arrest situations. I just can't get over it. And I was so nervous I sat down about 30 feet in front of where I was supposed to. So very gently grabbed me by the arm, put me up, and brought me over to where I was supposed to. The last conversation I had with him had to do with going to Iraq to see children who are suffering from malnutrition or suffering from gastrointestinal diseases, children who are suffering from cancers, saying that I should be out there speaking to as many audiences as possible. And that's what we do. That's what I'm doing. That's what we have been doing. And I just say we're doing the best we can, and let's remember those children.
She saw the names of the people that did the action, and she saw Philip there, and she wrote a letter, and she said, you know, you're a hero to me, I admire you so much, and what you've done is so pathetic and profound, it's the most truthful witness that I've ever heard. And she said, so Philip wrote her back, and he said, well, why don't you come out and meet us, you can do one of these. And he wrote him back right away and said, I would love to, but I run this place called the Martinez Center, and it's a community that works for peace and justice and does a lot of organizing and information sharing and people rely on me. And he wrote back and said, well, we do a bit of that ourselves here. And then he said, I think you should come out and meet with us. So she wrote another letter and she said, I would love to do it with you, but I can't because I have children. And he wrote a letter back and said, I have a few children myself. So he said, shortly after that, she went to Jonah House of Baltimore, and she said, I've pretty much been in prison ever since. She said, it's her great love, and with us all these years. I also just wanted to mention that Helen might be one of the first American prisoners of conscience that will be held under the Preventive Detention Act. She said, they're talking about rescinding her March 2004 release date. And there's three ways that you do that. The first is for her to be declared insane, which the psychiatrist in the prison that does the that speaks at the trials about that said that he would never be able to stand up, and much to our amazement, and say that she was insane. But he said he wouldn't do that, and he's been very clear with the prison authorities about that. The only other way would be if Bush signs an executive order, or if she's held under the conditions of the Patriot Act. So again, we should be very mindful of that as a symbol of what's coming ahead for us. The second Phil story I wanted to tell has to do with Ann Montgomery. I don't think he's in here. I think Ann's probably sitting in front of a bulldozer in heaven right now. But now that Phil is in heaven, we can name him as an unindicted co-conspirator for the last 5 years. Situation might be and what dangers might be encountered, and we were doing a role play. And some of us that were a little young were very intimidated because Phil was playing the part of the bad cop. And he was kind of shoving people and being a little brutal and ruthless, and he wanted us to be fully prepared for what might be coming. And we were a little freaked out, and Anne kind of said, "All right, Phil, I think that's good, that's enough, dear honey." And I looked at her with very big eyes, and she put her hand on my arm and said, "That's why we thank God every day that he's on our side." In the late 80s, and Phil, my husband Chris, and about 12 other people were arrested at the commission, which are a blessing of the Trident Submarine. And one of the ways they punish you when you get arrested is when these things where thousands of people come to celebrate and wave their flags is they put you into a, what's the alternative non-store word for a padman? A holding band, which is a metal car that's very hot and there's no air or circulation to keep the doors closed. So they had finally convinced the authorities that it was like 102 degrees, this was in August, and they opened up the back doors of the van, and Phil was sitting right at the back trying to get a breath of air, and my husband was trying to speak to the people 35 feet away that were going to the commission, and he's yelling things like, "The death of the innocents is on your hand," but very loud, and Phil was sitting quietly with one finger in his ear, and they kept closing the doors because people kept yelling. So finally, it got very hot. They left the doors open. They took the people that had been arrested away to the Groton County Jail, and they were merciful and put them out in an outside pen with a big fence around it. And as people, support people, and other people in the demonstration came to meet with the people who had been arrested, the guards would come out. The first 10 or 15 people came to approach the fence, and the guards came out and said, "No one can go near the prisoners. You'll all be arrested. Go away." Well, more and more people came. Pretty soon it was 50 people, and they had come out 4 or 5 times. 100 people came. They finally realized there's no way they're going to keep all these people away from the gate and the fence. So a sort of a picnic came about, and people were whipping out their peanut butter and jelly and sharing sandwiches. And then a car pulled up that made everyone very happy. It was Jim Newman, who also goes by the name Jim, how about a cold one? And Jim happened to have some cold beer in his car. He was able to fill a cup of cold beer and bring it over the fence to Phil, who by now is very hot and thirsty. And my favorite image of Phil is holding out his chain and fence and sticking his little lips out.
I am really trying hard in these days to remember Philip and his smile and his humor. And I was just thinking like that when I first met Philip, it was in the band room with a lot of smoke. People were huddling and we were at the Pentagon, and it was 1980. And I was searching for a group to act with. I had been with Cat Porters from New York, and I ended up without an affinity group. So I met with all these folks in the back room, and all these movement heavies, we called them. And Phil was wonderful. He would let anybody get arrested. I'm a testimony to it. I used to call him General Berrigan, and it's for me, it seems when I the last several days when I've woken up in the morning, the world does seem like a darker place with Phil not present. And I think that I want to remember that beautiful smile, the beautiful spirit, the commitment, and I think I'll leave with that. Thank you.
And also, I think Phil would want us all to remember that, don't mourn, organize. So I know I personally am planning to get arrested in resistance to the war on Iraq, and I'm going to do it in Phil's honor and memory.
condo with Phil Baltimore, Fayetteville, and some cloud sharing. The memory that I want to share with you centers on Baltimore's church. I met Phil in the early 60s. He had been transferred here for his teaching against war. And he was in his parish here with the pastor, Father Henry Offer. I met Phil at the same meeting in Baltimore. Same, if you remember way back, is one of the early groups against same nuclear policy. And I was active in the civil rights movement, and Phil was very active. So we came together after that meeting. To a friend who says to me, you want to meet this interesting priest? Today they would say, cool priest. We went to the Deutsch's house. We sat down, drank beer together, had some pretzels. And I said to myself, who is this priest who likes to talk to you, who's friendly, who's knowledgeable, who cares about you? And that began the relationship that continues to this time. And a relationship I have no regrets and am very, very blessed and grateful for. And there's something about this church, because this is where we had the civil rights marches. This is where they began, right in this church. As the choir sang, as we prayed the gospel, and we went out and we faced some risk here in Baltimore, from window amusement park to open housing, so on. The prayers, the leaving the church, and reading the word, and taking risk, the entire parish and friends. So tomorrow we pray again, and it's a different setting, and Phil will be praying for us, as he may be right now.
Once again, I was ordered by Elizabeth McAllister to have gender balance, and I can't do that. Unless Kathy, Mark, and Jackie Allen come up yet again.
Joe Cosgrove, and I met Philip when Dan was ministering to my family and to me when my mother was dying, and I was brought back to those tender times watching the next 2 months, and especially the other day, witnessing Dan and Liz, Jerry and Carol, and the children, and the Joe House community ministering in the same way to Philip. And at the time, I was in law school, and I thought that there could be nothing more useless to do with your life than be a lawyer. Phil wrote me a letter, an unsolicited letter at that time, and he said, you can do anything in light of the gospel, so long as you're willing to carry your cross. And he put a little footnote. He said, but you don't have to carry the whole thing. I'll never forget this. He said, just make sure you get a few splinters in your hand. So I hope my hand is splintered, but I can say from that moment, about 3 weeks after I was admitted to the bar, Dan introduced me to a death row inmate, and it hasn't stopped. And grace has continued, and I've been blessed to stand with probably half of you in court at one time or another. And so I just wanted to thank Philip for using me as a clay from which he could mold something, maybe that could hold something, maybe something sacramental at his hand. And as I see this lineup, after the directors, but as I see this lineup, there's something very resurrecting about Phil, just knowing that in my church, There are finally invitations for men and women of conscience to stand at the pulpit and speak their mind. And only Phil can do that. Only he can do that. Thank you, Phil. Amen.
My name is Sue Francis Drake, and I'd like to give a big thanks for gender balance, because the way that I got to see these in front of Scott figured up, he's better than mine. This is unusual for me that I don't have a kid pulling at my leg, and that's kind of been the story of my life for a long time. And so, consequently, I haven't had a lot of long conversations with Phil. He's been someone who I've loved for a long time. And there's a couple memories that really stick out for me in the time that I've known Phil. And one was quite a few years ago. I was living here in the day house at the time, and we had one of those many long, lonely meetings and planning a faith resistance retreat. And Phil and I were called down to the basement room of Dorothy Day House, and the door was shut. And Phil said, "I'd like you to consider an act of personal and political disarmament." We sat around and discussed it for a little while. Phil and I at this time were contemplating getting married, which was a big thing for those of priests, and there were a lot of issues around it. It was taking a lot of our time in the sermon. And so after the meeting, Phil and I went for a long walk, and Phil was all excited. This is the words of truth that come down. Personal and political disarmament. This is what it's all about. This is what we're supposed to be doing. We should definitely seriously consider this. I was just pissed. Here it's Phil. We're finally getting it together. Here we are in this long struggle. And now, because Phil said personal and political disarmament, we're supposed to put our life on hold and put our own camera on someone. And I said, "Phil, just said that because he knew it would get you crooked." But really, it was me who got hooked in by those words. And they just wouldn't leave my head. And of course, we ended up in a long process. And out of that have come a lot of the best things that have happened to me in my life. And I still often find myself thinking of those words, personal and political disarmament. And I'm so grateful for that, to have that message in there. That way of looking at how to move about the gospel. And I'm really grateful to Phil for that. And the other memory that I have of Phil is much more recent. I guess it was about 2 weeks ago. Phil and I woke up, like I'm sure many people in this room have over the years, feeling like we sometimes do, that we just need the Jonah House liturgy. So we came up to Baltimore and were able to be there for a really beautiful liturgy and had the privilege of having the opportunity to say goodbye to Phil. And once again, there weren't a lot of words spoken. Clearly, it was a struggle for Phil to even breathe at that point. And we didn't say a lot, but he held my hand in that strong grasp, looked me right in the eyes, those clear eyes, and he had a big smile. And it was so clear to me that here was a man who was not afraid of death. And it's an incredibly liberating thing, just like taking in that message of personal and political disarmament. And I'm just so grateful for Phil's life and for the privilege of being in conference.
I'm Scott Kipagopi from the Catholic Worker in Worcester, and I'm going to talk kind of fast because I'm the kind of guy that Connor gets the hook for. Unlike my good friend Tom Lewis and so many others, I was only 10 years old when Cadenceville happened. I was in the Cub Scouts. And in spite of the questions I get asked when I give talks, were you in Woodstock? I said, no, I was not. But I watched as a young person growing up in New England, I was somewhat enamored of Martin Luther King and maybe a little bit of Robert Kennedy, and I kind of had the impression, that these people were all being slaughtered. And by the time I went to college, and I went to Holy Cross, which is the school Phil went to, and I was very excited to go to college because I thought this was where I was going to really find radical ideas. By the time I got there in 1976, it was a radical idea to write a letter to the editor. And I was very, very disappointed. John Lewis in Worcester, who was introduced to me by another friend as a member of the Cadenceville Nine, which I didn't know what it was, but I said, this must be important. And Tom took me right to Baltimore to meet Bill and Liz and their children. And it was an extraordinary grace. Actually, I arrived there the day Jim Cunningham got out of jail. And Jim took me aside and he says, you know, in the peace movement, he says, there are big fish like Phil and Liz, and there are little fish that the feds won't go after. He said, I like to see myself as a medium fish. And I thought about this, and I had kind of that idea that there's a hierarchy, great people. You know, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, people you'd be tongue-tied when you're with. And I had certainly been introduced as Phil and Liz as great people. But right away, that was broken down talking to me. Right away, you felt like you were the most important person. You felt like you were very, very special. Really welcomed into their personal space. On that first weekend I was there, Phil and Liz were reading. They read aloud every night, which my wife and I have done to our kids since they practiced. They were reading Watership Down. Liz was nursing Katie. Jerry and Frida were sitting there. Phil's reading the book aloud. They invite me down into the bedroom to sit with the family. I mean, really intimate openness. And I remember Phil, when he finished the chapter, said, this book is a piece of crap. And that was the other thing, too. There's so much equivocation in this world. We're breathing so much carbon monoxide, so much diluted air. Talking to Phil was like being just breathing pure oxygen. I complained about my frustration with people, you know, who were moderate in my local community trying to get them to do things. And Phil says very matter-of-factly, well, you know, you scratch a liberal, you find a fascist. And I'm like, whoa. And we asked him to write an article for our newsletter once, and he sends it about civil disobedience, and he puts his own title on it, and the title is Choke Back and Excuses. And the last conversation I had with him was ironically about ROTC at Holy Cross, and we were talking on the phone, and I was talking about frustrations on the campus. And he goes, well, you know, there are moral amoebas out there. And like, only Phil would have that turn of phrase and that kind of thing. But I guess the most important thing for me was this realization of when he talked to us, he could talk to anybody, young, old, no matter who you were, Christian, non-Christian, atheist, whatever, he would invite you to the cross. No matter who you were, you didn't have to be somebody with credentials or a degree or whatever. He would, like Christ himself, he would ask you to accept the whole gospel. And he would ask it with hope. He would ask it with hope. He could see the saint that God wants each one of us to be. He could see it, and he tried to pull it out of us. And if we didn't accept it, not necessarily the particulars, but everything that God wants from us, like the rich man that Jesus calls to give away his goods, we go away sad, and we're diminished. And he wouldn't just give us one shot. He'd ask us again and again, believe me. Again and again and again. And it was like an extraordinary, extraordinary grace. And I was asked outside just a few minutes ago, as I come in because I was carrying a banner, and the press is desperate for a visual. And they wanted to know, was I really crushed today because Phil, you know, had gone to his resurrection. And I said, absolutely not. I said, we wanted Phil to speak in Worcester about ROTC. We were really looking forward to it. And, you know, he's in Baltimore, Worcester's kind of far away, and it's kind of hard to get him scheduled. Well, now he's in Worcester with us all the time. Now, every time we go to communion, every time we go to demonstrate, every time we go to jail, every time we go to the School of the Americas, stand in front of the tank, anyway, Phil Berrigan, I'm so glad that son is there. He is presented. He is with us. He is in the communion of saints. Celebrate because we know that he's in with God for all eternity, and we celebrate full-fledged. So let's celebrate, too. Let's not just cry. Let's celebrate. What a wonderful night. Thank you.
I'm Tom Seymour from D.C. And I first knew of Phil in the 60s. And I was a contract manager at Rockwell International shipping weapons to Vietnam. And I opened a paper. There's a couple of priests on the front page raising hell over the Vietnam War. And so right. I'm the paper shot. I had 7 children, and I wanted to keep my work. After 5 years, I was an alcoholic. And now, Phil bugged me all those times. And Dad, they bugged me all the time, like you do the Pentagon, like you do all that. And so, I was given 6 months to a year to live. When you're like that, you know, down and out, you make a lot of big promises. You know, like, dear God, I will work for peace the rest of my life. I didn't know I was going to live so long. He's in jail again. Oh, God, what can I do more for peace, you know? What can I do more? So I finally, you know, met Phil in 79. I said, I think my calling is to appeal to the Pope, the leaders of the church, to ban nuclear war. He said, you'd have a better chance changing the Pentagon. Inspires me every day to this day. And he will inspire all of us in this church every day to retire, to do something more for us.
Amen. Amen.
My name is Belinda Clark, and I met Father Berman here. I was a member of his church. I was in school here. The reason why we visit teacher on Monday mornings, at 8 o'clock in the morning, he never was late. Picture this. You know, you got to get up and go to church on Sunday, so mom made me get up and go, so when we go on Sunday, we make it do that. We come home. Monday morning, we got to go to school. The first person we have to deal with is Bob Burns. Can you imagine a person walking into the classroom Monday morning 6 feet tall? He's like 4 feet great. He's real tall. He's not taking no stuff from us. But, you know, he left something for us. He made his memorable for us. Even when we did camping, we were seeing like Saturday nights out there playing basketball, because we had a basketball court over there. And you just think he was just one of the guys, you know? But then came along, one of the teachers didn't show up, and he had to fill in for her, so he gave us an assignment. It was an English class composition, and the assignment was write the Pope and ask him how he feel about the dragon.
All right.
And I wanted to tell a short story about one of the first time that I met Phil, which was back in 1995. When I was preparing with Steve Kelly for a boxing match at Lockheed Martin. And I was very concerned about how I was going to get in the building, how we were going to get in the building. And I watched the building, went to the parking lot and watched Lockheed Martin for several days. Looked at people, looked how they got in, and I didn't see how we could possibly get in. It seemed impossible, and I was really concerned about it all the time. And Phil came out to California and drove around the parking lot with us, and he said, "Well, you do the best you can, and you leave the rest to God." And for me, that seemed like, that was really different advice. Not what I was used to, because I was used to sort of problem solving everything out exactly, so you knew exactly what was going to happen. And but I thought, okay, this is how Boucher's actions are done. Maybe I should listen. So as it turned out, when we went to go into the building, these big doors opened up in front of us, and we were able to walk right in. And I think, you know, in life, that's pretty good advice, and I try to remember that. One thing also that I remember about Phil all the time is his sense of gratitude. You know, he got out of prison this last time, at the same time I did it. His whole body was full of gratitude to be back in the community. And so that's what I remember, your sense of gratitude and doing the best you can and living the rest of it.
My name is Barry Roth. Others have a longer time, higher risks, more stories, more humor. I think it was Dan who first said, try to live in a way that you give others a chance to change how they live. First, I heard this. And Phil was always living an example that helped me and helped my family. And what I and Eurydice Hersey and Matthew Kennis most remember about Phil is his love, our feeling loved by him, our feeling his utter selflessness in his actions. So many times we hear no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's brother or sister. A couple of weeks ago, we were with Phil, and he was in a lot of pain and suffering and weak, and having to choose each word with each breath, and yet not the kind of agony that was to come. But he said, you know, I am so lucky to be here with all this support and all this love. Think of the poor people who do not have what I have here now. And so this is not only Phil's inspiring me to be with him, to lift the hammer and pour the blood, but to see indelibly his concern for us. So it is sad, and it is also a celebration. God's blessing was that Phil walked with us, and we feel him with us.
My name is Howard Moreland. In 1967, I was an Air Force lieutenant in Lubbock, Texas, earning a pair of Air Force pilot wings, which were the same program that George W. Bush did. And I knew I was against the war, but I was starting to feel the culture of the Texas Panhandle was really making me wonder what it was like to be in Nazi Germany in the late 1930s. I kept wondering what I was going to do, how I was going to preserve my options in the civilian aviation industry without actually having to fight in the war. And in the back of my mind, I knew something had happened in America, which to my knowledge did not happen in Nazi Germany during the 1930s, that two members of the Christian clergy had poured some blood on draft files. And I knew that there were people in America who did not support the war, and that it was possible to take another choice. I actually put in a tour of flying big transports over to Vietnam, hauling soldiers over there, bringing their bodies back and loading them in boxes. Cargo manifesto listed as HR, Human Remains, with a number of caskets in the box. Eventually, I did have to quit the Air Force under circumstances that did, in fact, destroy my possibilities of aviation career. I was a damn good pilot. You would have been lucky to have me flying your 747. But I chose another path, and it was the inspiration of the Berrigan brothers that helped me get through that very difficult transition, which I know many others made during that period of time. I actually had the privilege of meeting Bill on a number of occasions. My ongoing association with the Catholic Worker House in Washington. But I had a very memorable experience for a while. I was a full-time anti-nuclear activist, and I had the privilege of giving the warm-up speech at a Catholic church in St. Petersburg, Florida, before Daniel Berrigan spoke. And I was very impressed to notice there were at least 500 people there. It was a pretty big crowd for anything that an activist press thought. And they were all parishioners from that local area, and they were all there to hear Daniel. And as far as I could tell, all 500 of them disagreed with everything either one of us had to say about nuclear weapons. But they listened with great respect, and the interaction between Dan and the congregation as they were discussing the morality of nuclear weapons there just made me realize that America has been very blessed to have these two brothers amongst us.
I'm Kathy Boylan, and I'm a... thank you very much. I was 24 years old. I had two little babies, boys. Tim, who is here tonight, is 6 months old, and Hugh, his older brother, is 17 months old. And I was expecting Michael on May 17, 1968. And it was late in the afternoon. I turned on the radio at home. Unfortunately, it wasn't Pacifica, I know that. It was commercial radio. So I look back and think, what could time allotment would a commercial radio station have allotted to the Catonsville action? So I imagine it was a minute, maybe a minute and a half, something like that. But I heard about the Catonsville action with Phil and Dan and Tom Lewis and all the other wonderful people who acted burning rabbis here in Catonsville, Maryland. And I described the feeling as I was struck in my heart and I stood up a different person. The war was just, it was, you know, I was doing CCD and taking care of my kids and trying to be a good neighbor, and, you know, the war was something out there I think what happened to me is that my brother, when I was a little girl, was 4 and a half, my brother died when I was 4 and a half, he was 3 and a half, he died from leukemia, and I lived with parents who grieved for their child all my life. And I think that I knew that war, I knew it was all wrong, but here were people loving enough, caring enough, committed enough to say no to it. And that's what struck me apart. I stood up a different person, just like weeks ago, when I heard that Phil was diagnosed with cancer, I was almost in prison. And I wrote to Phil and Liz
and thank them, because I shudder to think, where would I have been if I hadn't, you know, hadn't heard about Kingsville? What would my life have been like? And I'm so blessed that you acted, and that I know you all, and you're my friends. So anyway, that happened, and then in 1991, I was in a club transaction with Bill at Bath Maine, and Aegis Carrier is what we put him on. And we were taken to the local court, and the judge wanted us, he said, okay, we'll release you, or you must sign, you promise to return, and we all agreed we weren't going to sign anything. So we were carted off to jail, all of us, and then 2 days later, so they came back in the middle of the night, they say, and without handcuffs. I thought that was kind of strange, and we're all back in court, and Mr. Phil, the judge said, Philip Berrigan, and Phil stood up, and he said, Philip Berrigan, this is a federal judge, I know you are the conscience of a generation. And I was honored to be here. And then the judge said, and if you say you're coming back for trial, then you're coming back. But, just mostly I want to say thank you. Thank you, my dear, dear friends. And that's, I no longer call you whatever I call you, friends. And that's what you are. Thank you so much. God bless you all.
My name is Axel Chesky. I'm with the Baltimore Emergency Response Network. And the only reason I'm here today is because of Dan and Phil Berrigan. Some of you know me by Max the Vax. And I want to enlighten you a little bit today on some stories that I think the media has missed about Phil. And principally, that is the idea of how he worked very closely when he was out of jail, obviously, with the local protest scene here. And I'm going to take the story a little further by telling you a little bit about Phil's favorite people, judges. Okay, imagine 1991, 8 of us are arrested at the Applied Physics Laboratory, Johns Hopkins University's Applied Physics Laboratory. They work on weapons of mass destruction. And many occasions we've tried to do weapons inspections out there, and we've been in turn arrested for trying that. But this particular time, 8 of us are arrested, this is here someplace. She was one of the defendants in court that day. And we went before one of our favorite judges, I'll name the names today, by the way, Judge James Vaughn. And he was a nemesis of ours, we've been informed many times, and we were not allowed to mention any dirty words in his courtroom. We could not say anything about nuclear weapons research. That was taboo. So I don't know if George Austin is here today, but he was the first defendant to mention those dirty words, nuclear weapons research, in the Applied Physics Laboratory. He was charged with contempt and hauled away. Well, Phil was in court that day, and a coach away from the Baltimore Sun, Phil said, let him speak, judge. And the judge warned him and threatened him with contempt. Well, the next defendant came up and basically said the same thing, and Phil interjected, and this time, besides saying, well, let him speak, judge, he said, this court is a disgrace. And naturally, Judge Vaughn called him off. I was the fourth member of the group to be hauled off for contempt, so now there's 5 of us behind the judge's chambers. So Judge Vaughn eventually brings the 4 of us in, and he dismisses the contempt charges against the 4 of us, but he wants Phil to apologize. Mr. Berrigan responded to Baltimore Sun, March 27, 1992. I will change my position when you allow people in this court to make statements about the APL to explain their situation. Judge Vaughn did not appreciate that and sentenced Phil to 5 years in prison. We immediately started organizing demonstrations, contacted the media, et cetera, had a demonstration in front of the courthouse. the next day. And while we were demonstrating outside the courthouse, the media actually brought Phil back to us in front of the courthouse. The judge immediately released him back into the day once the pressure came down on Judge John Vaughn. The next judge, Judge Lewis Becker, who captured Judge again out of Howard County. Sister Margaret McKenna is here somewhere today. She, Phil, and I went into the Applied Physics Laboratory Director's Office. We took with us a copy of the Nuremberg Principles and what? Human blood, the whole blood. We posted the Nuremberg Principles on the lab director's door, and then we poured our blood over the Nuremberg Principles. That's when we were arrested. We're charged with, I think, three offenses. We wind up in Howard County Court, just about 20 miles outside of Baltimore, before Judge Lewis Becker, the good Catholic judge. And Father Barry, Sister McKenna, and me, then Max, or Mr. Olszewski, probably. He found us guilty, but he sentenced us to time served. Well, the next time I appeared before Judge Becker, I'm by myself. There were no nuns, no priests with me. He found me guilty and sentenced me, there's Sister Margaret McKenna right there, sentenced me to 30 days in the Howard County Detention Center. I actually had to go in, I believe, at 4 a.m. on the 4th of July. I was going to Judge Becker. So the lesson, I think everyone should have learned, if you're getting arrested, you're getting busted, make sure you have some nuns and priests along with you. Now, the final judge story, Captain Wolden has sort of taken it out of my lips, but I'll give you a name, I promise to give you a name. Now, the thing to remember about that way works, right across the road to the courthouse, a very quaint old courthouse. And this was February of 1997. Phil and the others handled on each as a destroyer. So they were eventually taken over to this quaint little courthouse, and it was Judge Joseph Field. And the exact quote that he said was, "Anyone of my generation knows Phil Barrigan. He is a moral giant, the conscience of a new generation." Now, I haven't run into too many honest judges in my travels, but here we have an honest judge. Thank you.
My greatest claim to fame, unlike Melinda, who had him as his teacher when she was in the fourth grade, I had him when I was 69, pushing 70. And it was the symbol that's missing, I think, is an axe. Because I had the privilege of holding the logs, so I feel like a rebel, while Phil exercised one of his favorite pastimes, and splitting the wood. So I had this great privilege of getting that risk, and also not leaving it all to God, because nothing ever happened. And here I was holding the log, sometimes for 2 or 3 hours, and I felt that glow in every bone of my body. And Phil never worried about it, and I didn't worry about it. And I was even able to pick up the split pieces and pile them in a beautiful pile that's so artistic here. But the symbol to me is that, like the hammer, but the axe was chopping in the wood, the wonderful wood that lights the fire, the flame in our hearts. So thank you.
I'm John Shushard, here with my wife Carrie from the House of Peace in Ipswich, Massachusetts. And I received calls yesterday from Father Richard at the Western Priory, the monks of the Benedictine monks in Vermont, all send their love, their solidarity to all of the Barrigan family. I received calls from the Board of Directors of Veterans for Peace, who also called Philip Barrigan 36 by reference from and by and through Dan, who I had gone to seeking advice on a letter I had written to the IRS saying that I was no longer paid for war or nuclear weapons. And I wasn't sure about the content of my letter, and I knew I was going to someone who was world famous, was a moral example and leader, and I was looking, of course, for his input. He handed it back to me after carefully reading it. There wasn't a word. I said, "Well, what do you think?" He said, "It's your letter." And that was what I learned through Phil and Dan, that they weren't going to leave my life for me or anybody else's life for them. Their moral leadership respected our freedom and left us the responsibility to live our lives fully ourselves. I'm sure that we have all been reflecting on now what the first month of October means for the world. The birth of Gandhi on the 2nd of October, the birth of Francis of Assisi on the 4th, and the birth of Reverend Philip Berrigan on the 5th. A constellation of the world's greatest exemplars of repentance and of the renunciation of violence in all its forms. It was only in these past few days that I was struck by Philip's middle name, Francis, that both Francis and Philip were heavy combat veterans and survivors of the savagery and destruction of war. And both underwent powerful inner conversion through Christ. And both gave the full force of their life energies to the abolition of war. A responsibility friend Phil's friend Thomas Merton called the supreme obligation of Christian discipleship, taking precedence over absolutely everything else. Now, I too was lucky enough to be in the courtroom and have the joy on the second occasion that Judge Field looked out and said, "I see here a man who was a conscience of the entire generation of America. Set that man free." But of course, free Phil always was and always had been. I've never known a man more free. And now I know that in his newfound freedom, Philip Berrigan, like Gandhi, like St. Francis, will go out further and further into the world and into more and more lives. Prisoner no more, light of conscience for all of us.
I decided to speak because I'm a woman and was asked. That time in the courtroom, I also was there. We had come up to see the trial and we were let free. And this, what everybody has said is true, but it, after that he said, "And those people that are with him, I judge by the company they keep." And maybe we can remember that we are friends of Phil, and we can remember to be part of the company that he would be proud to keep. We then got in the car, and he rode with us, since he hadn't been planning, and some others did, down to ALC in New York. But the trouble was, when he'd been in the back works, he had left something when he was climbing over the fence. So he had us ride back to the scene of the crime. And I was terrified. But it was a wonderful experience. The last time I was talking to Phil, I guess it wasn't the last time, but one of the last times, we were talking about depleted uranium. And when we were bombing depleted uranium in the mountains, on those caves that people had lived in for generations, and I was talking about how terrible it was. us. It would be like bombing our Hopi villages for us to bomb because the Taliban had passed through to bomb those. And he said, yes, but even worse. But that is where all the water in Afghanistan comes from. So when we bomb with depleted uranium, we are making everybody who drinks that water more apt to get cancer. I'll leave you with two things, not from Phil, but from Dan. They're two of my favorite Dan quotes. One, if you want to think, you follow. One, he was talking to me and I said, my father taught me moderation in all things. He said, you ought to moderate your moderation. And the other one is, if you want to follow Christ, you better think you look good on wood.
Three people have referred to this thing that the judge said that was so nice, and I don't know if it's urban folklore, but I think Barry Roth said that a couple of weeks ago that Phil's response was, when they start to compliment you, be on your guard. And I think that's part of the message, is not to be sucked in. My name's Terry Fitzgerald. I graduated from high school in 1967, and I went to the California Institute of Technology, which is this great science school, and which is the home of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which we always thought was running things for research for space, and we all know is just a horror for the Pentagon, and is part of prostituting space. And I, in 67, 68, as a freshman, actually was considering joining the Marines when I finished, when I got my degree. And in 1968, there are a number of things that occurred that had a profound impact on me. And of course, one of them was the action of Dan and Phil and Tom Lewis and Brother David Darst and these folks in Catonsville. And it had a ripple effect, which we can tell you about many, many times, but I don't believe you can ever really grasp. And I speak, I know, for thousands whose lives were changed by this seminal event in our lives. And thank you, Phil, and thank you, Dan and Tom, and so many others, because we stand on the shoulders of those who have gone before us. And Phil is not a saint in this terms that these judges and so forth will make him out to be a saint. Phil is a saint because he follows the law of God. And Dan is not a great person because he's some holy so-and-so, but because of what he says. And a couple of weeks ago, Phil was leading the... I'm blessed to be a fellow traveler with Jonah House. I live in Baltimore. And in fact, in many ways, it's because of what I just mentioned, the events that changed my life. And Phil was leading a discussion, and he said, prayer is everything. Wait a minute. Who are you? Prayer is everything? Who is this guy saying prayer is everything? And I want to read something that was written a few years ago that puts this into context. And it's a reading from the Haftarah for Yom Kippur, the reading from the prophets for Yom Kippur, which is the holiest day in the year, and in which it's traditional to fast from everything. And this is from Isaiah. And Isaiah is quoting God. And God says, they ask of me the right way, as though eager for the nearness of God. When we fast, they say, why do you take no heed? Why, when we afflict ourselves, do you take no notice? God responds, because on your fast day, you think only of your business. This is Isaiah writing a few years ago. Because on your fast day, you think only of your business and oppress all your workers. Because your fasting leads only to strife and discord, hitting out with a cruel fist. Such a way of fasting on this day will not help you to be heard on high. Is this the fast I look for, a day of self-affliction, bowing your head like a reed and covering yourself with sackcloth and ashes? Is this what you call a fast, a day acceptable to the Lord? Don't you think instead that this is the fast that I look for? To unlock the shackles of injustice, to undo the fetters of bondage, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every cruel chain. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, and to bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to clothe them and
ready to sign it. And so the judge said, and it was Orrin Hatch, I think, Robert Orrin. And so the judge said, well, if Mr. Meriden says he didn't pour blood, then he didn't pour blood.
Tell people, this is after 8 o'clock now. 2 minutes per speaker. Patrick O'Neill, I gave you the job. Patrick O'Neill is the last one I'm on.
It's a long line. For some of us, it's easier to burn draft files than it is to stand up in front of the crowd. 2 minutes, I guess. 1 minute for a reason for telling a story, and the other minute to tell one. I've been reflecting, thinking about a concept that is alive and well in, we're told, some nations in West Africa, the concept of that folks are divided into three groups. There's the living, the near dead, and the dead, the really dead. And you remain in the near dead, what are called the Sasha. You remain in the Sasha as long as there are others alive who know you and tell stories about you. Once those people all pass, you go from the Sasha to the Zamani. And so the reason for telling these stories is to testify to the fact that Phil is in the Sasha. Phil is in the living dead. And now onto the story. I've changed it about 10 times since I've been in the line. But really, it's just to tell you all that what several people have said already. Sometime about 35 years ago, plus or minus a half a year, I guess, I was doing duty on the telephone to the Draft Counseling Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And one of the other guys working that night said that somebody from Catonsville, Maine was coming to speak to a small group of people that night, and I said, what was the Catonsville Nine? Oh, that was the Berrigan Brothers. I said, well, okay, who are the Berrigan Brothers, and what did they do? And he told me, and I said, whoa, is that great? And my life has not been the same since. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Cindy Chabert, and I'm a student at Oberlin College, where Katie Berrigan goes to school. She's from mine. I only knew Phil for a year, about a year and a half ago when I went to the Joan House, and doing that, I was a little nervous about meeting Phil Berrigan, and everyone. I'd heard quite a bit about him, and I just figured I would watch and see what he was like, and that he wouldn't really have time to talk to me when I was there. That was wrong. There was one point where I was sitting down with Phil, and just the two of us, and he asked me, he looked at me and straight in the eyes. A lot of people have heard him doing. And he asked me why I was here, what had brought me here, and I said, what brought me to Joan House? And he said, yes, but what brought you here to a place where you were thinking about peace and you're thinking about where you fit in the world? Just very direct, and it was strange because he looked at me and I could see in his eyes, certainly very much a challenge. I mean, he wanted me to answer honestly, but there was also a huge amount of love, and I talked to him for about 15 or 20 minutes, and I can tell you about the whole conversation, but pretty much the thing that struck me the most was how much love I saw in his eyes, someone I met like a day and a half before. And I was brought up in the Episcopal Church and kept hearing, love your neighbor as yourself. And I understood that too, but I didn't really see it. I mean, around me, like
what's that really mean? People don't really seem to be doing that. And as I learned more about Phil and the Jonah House community through being there and through Kate, I finally saw that phrase in practice, which was amazing because I definitely the type of person who needs to see something to really it. And one of the biggest things that I took away from that week is just how much love is. How love is, how it's possible to love everyone, even as certain gentlemen said, love our enemies, love our neighbors. And it reminded me of a conversation that I had with Kate once, where I just didn't understand. I mean, my parents had always been there when I was growing up, and I was like, I don't understand how you are when there were times when your parents were in jail. And she told me that even when her parents couldn't be with her, she always knew that they loved her. And I was really inspired by Phil's ability to love and Kate's ability to love. And everyone in Jonah House community. And Phil, I want to thank you for doing a ton of really great things, but on behalf of everyone at Oberlin and all of Kate's friends, I want to bring this Kate because she has touched me. And I love you, Kate, and I love you, Phil. Thank you very much.
My name is Fran Donovan, and I was associated for a long time with the American Friends Service Committee. I spent a lot of family gatherings trying to explain the barricades and board actions and things like that to my family, and I often said I was going to bring them to show and tell so that they could speak for themselves, and I wish I had. I'd like to tell about Phil and young people. I often went into schools, high school especially, and Phil would accompany me. And the students were very curious about him. And he would sit there, and as the young woman just said, he looks you straight in the eye and just tells it like it is. And what I was most impressed with, he didn't tell them what they wanted to hear. He told them what he needed to tell them and what they needed to hear. And he even said that. You need to hear this, and you need to say it, and you need to voice it. So he was not only the conscience, he was also the voice, as are the proud shares, and certainly the whole Jonah House family. Thank you.
My name is Jim Moon, and I come from Waterbury, Connecticut, one of Phil's least favorite cities. He has a pet name for Waterbury that I won't repeat here. Spoke with Phil during the fall winter of March of 66, ranging from coming to Waterbury in March of 67 to speak at a Jackie and Rachel Council gathering at a local public high school. Of course, during the day, we ran Phil to a number of other things, a peace vigil, social service agencies, the Rotary Club, where we were specifically told that if Phil mentioned the word Vietnam, he and we were out of there. Phil managed to work a few things in without having to use the name Vietnam. Following later in the afternoon, we had a reception for Phil where he received the keys to the city from the mayor. There were about 1,000 people on a poll March night to hear Phil speak. He spoke on racial justice. Somehow, and I can't quite remember, during the question and answer period, something about the war in Vietnam came up. From there on, it was pretty much chaos. People were yelling and screaming, village yelling back, people were walking out. The next morning's paper, a picture called the afternoon paper, a picture of the mayor with the Marine Corps Committee putting an "I support our boys in Vietnam" bumper sticker on his car, because the morning paper carried a picture of the mayor giving Phil the keys to the city. 2 weeks later, the Board of Education voted not to allow subversive organizations to use the public school system. The one I'm interested in part was the following that we did one more meeting of the Catholic Interracial Council, and that had to be chaos. And I told Phil that he was instrumental in destroying the Catholic Interracial Council in one area.
Hi, I'm Denise Richter. I'm actually an introvert. But Jonah Haus came into my life in 1976. Jonah Haus came into my life in 1976 when my mother was looking for some reliable painters, and sort of it's been uphill since then. Phil has had an interesting effect in my life. I'm now an attorney, and I've done a lot of trials with Phil and many of you in this room. It's helped shape me who I am as a lawyer. I learned that there's the ungraded Thomas Gutierrez-ism, which we all have 10 or 12 trial dates with, and then there's Phil, who the action was the means and the end. And if I would suggest a motion, he would say, well, whatever you feel you need to do, not what I need to do. But for the last 26 years, I've thought about Phil probably a couple times a week, because there are two things. If I ever leave the water running when I brush my teeth and washing dishes, I hear this gentle chastisement about the value of water. And the second is I always turn the sound off during commercials, which is something that in many ways, I think those are more important life lessons of how we live our daily lives than the
I am as a lawyer. Just how I live every minute.
Thank you.
My name is Claire Schaefer Duffy, and I'm with the St. Francis Center as a Catholic worker in Worcester. I just want to read an excerpt of a tribute that David O'Brien, professor at Holy Cross College, wrote on Phil's behalf yesterday. Phil graduated from Holy Cross College in 1950 and majored in English. I am the worst of weepers, so if I collapse, stop. Time magazine once referred to Holy Cross as the cradle of the Catholic left, because it educated Phil Berrigan and socialist leader Michael Harrington, author of the influential attack on poverty, the other America. In 1971, college dedicated an issue of the Holy Cross Quarterly to the Berrigans. It later appeared as a well-received paperback book. The college awarded Daniel an honorary degree and invited him to deliver the commencement address in 1973. A poet, spiritual guide, and Jesuit, Daniel appeared regularly at Holy Cross, most recently delivering a powerful meditation on America after September 11, during our spring 2002 conference, The Anatomy of Evil. Phil was less welcome, perhaps because he was an agitator with very firm convictions, unskilled at that.